This is Passing Notes from the History of Education Society.
Welcome to the first episode of a series of four to accompany the May special edition of the History of Education Journal. Michael Donnet speaks to Desmond Ikenna Adugu about his article, Education in Africa, a critical historiographic review. I'll hand you back to Michael for the podcast.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm so excited to have you here and to be talking about your article today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here as well.
So I think maybe the best place to start today's conversation, and I imagine also probably the most challenging place to start, is with the question that you opened the article with, which is, you know, is it possible and appropriate to be writing about the history of education in Africa? And in the article, you lay out a couple of the sort of specific challenges inherent in that framing. And I was wondering if we could start by just walking through a couple of them. Sort of what do you see as the philosophical or historical challenges with framing the question, the history of education in Africa, in that way?
Thank you, Michael. You know, when the journal editors invited me to contribute a piece to this anniversary issue, I said an enthusiastic yes, you know, because I've been working on a project that's related to that subject. So I was very delighted to have the opportunity to work on this. But then after I had a moment past this enthusiasm, when I started thinking about what I had just accepted to do, I started to think to myself, what have you done? Like, what have you gotten yourself into? Because, you know, I started thinking about these fundamental questions and their implications for any attempt to make sense of the history of education in Africa. Put this in quote, history of education in Africa, because then you realize that this as a departure point, one must ask, what history, what education, what Africa? You know, and I don't engage in these questions thoroughly in this piece because they are far beyond the scope of the immediate project. You know, what I attempt to do is just to raise questions about, to remind any reader that these are valid questions to ask, and that asking those questions has very serious historiographic implications. You know, like you suggest, one of the questions I raise about history itself, you know, has to do with one of the thorniest issues that historians have to deal with, you know, the question of objectivity, you know. Of course, this is not a new question, and the linguistic turn, has litigated the epistemological implications for decades. I'm thinking of the works of E.H. Carr, for instance, Alan Munslow, and so many others who've wrestled with this for quite some time. And this is not even to talk about people who have been dealing with this for more than a century now. But as historians, you know, do we have an obligation to explore a variety of possible and sometimes incompatible interpretations beyond the temptations of one true narrative or one true interpretation? And what does that do to our concept of truth? What does that do to that referential obligation that people assume a historian has to represent reality the way it truly happened, or represent the past the way it truly happened? So I think just to understand history from that philosophical standpoint gives you a pause. It makes you want to hold off before you jump quickly into any conversation and say, hey, this is the history of anything, or to review any history of anything. And to raise a similar question about education, and this was where I was approaching this, I think you have another set of hairy challenges to deal with. You know, when we talk about education, I think most historians of education might find it compelling to focus primarily, if not exclusively, on Western-style formal schooling that dates, you know, to the era of empire building. But, you know, are these the only educational interventions since and within that time period? Even if we set aside questions about education in the period before Europe's empire building era, and I don't think we should. Right, I think we should not set aside, you know, what education was happening before, you know, the 15th, 16th centuries coming forward. But even if we set aside that, is formal schooling the only thing that was happening education-wise? I don't think so. And this is a very basic anthropological question or question that one can address quickly with some basic access to anthropological data. So if you want to talk about the history of education and the ways that people have wrestled with that, and you recognize that there's more to education than what's been happening in the four walls of the classroom with a teacher in front and some desks and students guided by some text, and the nation state institutions that superintends over this, if you realize that's just one very small part of a larger picture, how do you engage with a subject, right? And again, this is also not to even engage with the distinction that people often make between multiple levels of education. And even the thing I'm calling formal education here in distinction from non-formal or informal education are portmanteaus for handling very complex and varied phenomena. And again, these are portmanteaus that were developed within a particular historical period and from a particular historical vantage point. So if you throw those vantage points into question, then really what is education and what is not? If I use John Dewey, and I think I point to John Dewey in this space, if I use John Dewey as a reference point to think of education as fundamental experience, and move from that perspective, how do you make a distinction between what is education and what is not, right? How do you end up not making this a history of everything, like attempting to review a history of everything? And I don't think this is a meaningless question. I think it perhaps should be of concern to any historian. And the thought piece here, and I spent a bit of time on this because it's been a subject that I've had occasion to engage with as a student myself, the question of what Africa is. It's difficult to figure out where to start addressing that because, geographic contiguity, I mean, to think in cartographic terms, isn't always very helpful. Places that are considered one single unit are not often geographically contiguous, and we have plenty of examples about this. Otherwise, Europe and Russia and throughout most of Asia all the way to China would form one continent. If you think of a place you can just travel on land from place to place, you'll get to the other end. There are places that are disconnected but are part of, a particular geographic units in the ways that we define that. So how do we define Africa geographically? One of the simpler but also more striking elements here is that, Africa as a continent, as a geographic unit, is often cut into subregions, right? And one of the obvious ones is to think of North Africa versus Sub-Saharan Africa. And many people in the world of comparative and international education group North Africa together with the Middle East to form what is often called the Middle East and North Africa as a transcontinental or cross-continental sub-region, and then keep Sub-Saharan Africa separate. And I think that's striking because, again, you would want to think of North Africa as part of the continent of Africa. But when it comes to education programming and the history of education, you find people that consider it more meaningful to group the continent, part of the continent, together with a different part of a different continent. So is Africa still one thing if we think of the educational developments across a particular time period, even if we don't consider all time periods? So geographic delineations is not very helpful in figuring out what is inside or outside of Africa. Notice here that we're not even talking about the sources of educational interventions on the continent or places where education developments in Africa have shaped development. So if you think of the movement of people who might have started their lives on the African continent but ended up elsewhere, the educational implications of all of that. We're not talking about all of that, right? It's just the basic delineation of the geography itself. While I was working on this piece, I was reminded in reading Paul Zeleza's work that even the term, the word Africa itself, which has several origins, none of which are from Africa itself, has sort of changed its meaning from its original application to North Africa. So initially was applied to North Africa in its original term or Egyptian term. I think it was either Greek or Egyptian, they were using the word Libya. That was in reference to North Africa. Over time, and more recently, that word would be applied to the Sub-Saharan region. to the point that today many people will consider the sub-Saharan region as the real Africa. And that extension of the term to the southern part of the continent has also come with some increasing pejorative use of that term. So it began to sort of suggest a movement toward deficit, a continent of problems, of needs. That's different from the way that that term originated. And I think there are many people today who would suggest, you know, to abandon the word Africa entirely and use some other term that is indigenous to the continent. And you know, there are so many ways you can ask this question that points to the fact that as a continent, the identity of Africa is a question. You know, Mudimbe, A.Y. Mudimbe, for instance, you know, raises that question about how Africa was constructing his work at the invention of Africa. But I find very useful to understand that is there is nothing obvious about this continent, so to speak, at least the way we look at it. If we were to ask the question about what Africa is from a demographic standpoint, for instance, then we engage with a different set of challenges. You know, how do you consider you know, Africans in the diaspora as Africans? And I'm not just talking about those who were moved or who moved voluntarily from Africa to other parts of the world, myself included, but people who were forcefully removed from the continent under slavery and can't find their way back home to their ancestral homelands anymore, right? In the US, for instance, there is a development, a cultural development to think of African Americans as Blacks instead of African Americans. A note to say there is nothing African about them, you know, the same way that someone will use the term white to describe people of European descent, right? And the idea here is, you know, if we call some people whites, why do we call others African Americans instead of Blacks, right? Although I find those terms so mind-bendingly absurd. But the question is, how could you also exclude African Americans from the corpus of what it means to be African? This is just to use the US as an example. You can say the same thing about Haiti or the Dominican Republic or wherever else you go. Or how can you include such a person in what it means to be African when the person has had no personal lived connection to the continent, except that there is a trace of genetic link in the history to indicate what that trace looks like, where it's come from, right? On the other end, you think of places like South Africa, where you have a significant population that are not of African descent, that is, are of European descent or Asian descent, who now identify as Africans. I'll tell you a quick story. I was at a conference several years ago and was at dinner table after the sessions with a group of people that I was meeting for the first time. And when we were going around to introduce ourselves, someone introduced himself as, I think they were from I think they introduced themselves as Zimbabwean. And I would have thought of this person as a European because they looked racially European. And, you know, this was many years ago, early in graduate school. And I asked the person, how come you are a Zimbabwean? I would have thought of a Zimbabwean as a country of Black Africans. And they were very insistent that they were Zimbabweans. Like they had no other lived connection to Europe, except that racially they look like what we call white, right? But from a lived experience, from a cultural experience, they come from the country Zimbabwe. Now, how do you include such a person or exclude such a person, by the way, from what it means to be African? And South Africa presents a very interesting case, for instance, because if you follow recent South African politics, you know that a lot of South Africans continue to be upset and demand, a reform of land ownership in South Africa, because even well after Mandela and Mandela's effort to engage in land reform, the majority of South African lands remain in the hands of a handful of people of European descent and to a smaller extent, people of Asian descent. And the majority, 80% of the population, have been displaced. So how do you consider people whose Africanness owe its origin to an effort to overrun, or one might even argue to destroy Africa? How can you consider such a person an African Or how can you exclude the person from being an African when they have an African country's passport? So to me, these things are present day, real, very serious issues that can be easily overlooked. So any historical inquiry, any efforts to engage with a review of any history of anything with regard to Africa, I think has to deal with these questions. Again, I do not engage with these issues thoroughly in this paper. What I do attempt to do, however, is to suggest that whether we engage with them has tall and telling consequences for what we call history, the questions we choose to pursue, what we search for as sources, including the modalities of such sources, whether they are written, oral, social, and so forth, the nature of our interpretations and the assumptions that guide those interpretations, and importantly, how we represent or present those interpretations, who our audience is, and how we share that information. All of that have some connection to the ways that we ask these very basic questions about what it is to think of history, or to think of education, to think of Africa all together as one.
And I think I so appreciated you opening the article with those questions, because I think it does exactly that. It unsettles the assumptions we might bring in when reading an article about sort of what we are coming to inspect, what we're coming to think about. And then what I really love is you then transition, and having asked those questions and having unsettled those assumptions, go and sort of, in looking at the historiography, look at a couple of what you call lessons, sort of thinking about how academic historians, particularly those working in sort of European and North American contexts, have in the past thought about education in Africa. And sort of listening to you sort of talk about the ways we think about audience, I would love to maybe start with the lesson about language and how different spheres of language and their relationships to colonialism still shape the way that scholarship on Africa is written. So I was wondering, maybe we can talk about that as sort of the first lesson to dive into.
I like that, because, you know, when I started developing my ideas for that piece, one of the things I had to wrestle with, especially in coming to terms with the fact that I was working on this project, is that I had to recognize that I was talking to a very specific audience. If I was having a conversation with my father, or with a group of elders in my hometown, the way I engage with the question would be radically different from the ways that I was trying to engage with it in this piece. And that sort of opened up the broader question to me about who's engaging with history, or the history of education in Africa, and in what context, and who are their audiences. So I think one can address this at two general levels. On one level, I think it's the recognition that we are wrestling with an academic subject. And by academic, I mean a particular presentation of what it means to be academic. So the Western style scholarly engagements that often come out in journal publications or in monographs and so forth. That's a very small group of people when you think of the number of people that inhabit this planet. And people who, by the way, have daily reasons to engage with similar questions that historians ask. You know, what is education? Where did it start? What is the purpose? And so forth. Who makes what decision? In whose interest and for what purpose? Right? And when we think about that particular community, that small community of experts, there are divisions. There are silos, if you want to think about it as such. That I think one can raise questions about. That is why those silos exist. But perhaps, you know, might find some tentative explanations, even if those are speculations, about why those silos exist. You know, but I think on the other, and this is the other side of the questions that one can raise here, is that when we leave the academic world, the academic world of the historian, and then turn in a different direction, the conversations people have, the historical historically grounded conversations that people have about education, are directly in conversation with the realities on the ground that they live with. And if we have time, I can speak a little bit more to that. That's coming out of the other project I've been working on. What is striking is that I don't think that there is also enough conversation between those two groups, that's the academic historians and these other historical enterprises, right? And in some ways, I think that's actually the larger problem. Because among historians who occupy different sides of these siloed fences, one can see some continuities, one can see some similarities. You can see, for instance, people drawing from similar sources, people wrestling with similar questions, people engaging in some sort of interpretive or discursive practices and so forth. So there are some similarities there. And even when there aren't any explicit direct conversations or engagements across the board, you can see those similarities. But when you think of, the engagement between academic historians and the rest of the people who they often, or who someone might think they speak for, or the realities they tend to represent, that's where I think, I don't speak personally, maybe it's happening somewhere that I don't see, but I don't know that I've seen enough of an engagement there. Now, to go back to the academic side of that fence, I function primarily in my scholarship in the English language, okay? But the English language is not the only language I have access to, and this is part of how I get to know that there are other conversations happening elsewhere. But as I was reading, the English conversation, the English work on the history of Egyptian and Africa, as large and complex as they can be, although, as I note in this piece, the majority of them are obsessed with colonial education, which I find just by its own, which I find interesting on its own account. I think there's something to be explored there, that the majority of works on education in Africa that's published in Western journals and scholarly output scholarly spaces are on colonial education. I suggest in this piece, I don't explore this as actively, but I suggest in this piece that this might be, Western education seeking images or seeking to represent image or reproduce images of itself elsewhere, right? But again, to focus on the scholarly side of things, as I was reading this, I noticed that there isn't enough coverage of other African contexts that are not English speaking, that is outside of the Anglophone African context. And I even say the Anglophone with a lot of hesitation because I don't know of a truly Anglophone African context. I think one can call it Anglophone if you're looking, if you parachute from, a Western standpoint and look at that, and all you see is the English language, or if you say Francophone, you only see is French. But anyway, not to go into that part of the ambiguities there, but I started asking myself questions about how do you capture what's happening in the so-called French-speaking African context, or the Spanish-speaking African context, or Portuguese-speaking African context. How do you capture educational realities historically from this context? And it became clear to me that with the exception of a few authors, and I'm talking about very few authors who have attempted to run a comparative historical analysis of an Anglophone and Francophone, context, there aren't many works that speak directly to the other side of things. And I decided at the point to look for journals in those other languages. And I started with French, and it was quite striking to me that, there are several French history of education journals that publish actively. Now, I'm not a fluent French reader or speaker. I did have some exposure to French, and in my attempt to read these pieces, I was delighted to realize that there are also translations of those publications for many of those journals. I think the French La Historie d'Éducation, I think it's called, has for virtually all its publications that I could see, an English translation of the full article, not just the abstract, that makes it easy for you to read what is happening in that journal. Right. And I realized when I started looking at this that many other journals in other languages, not just French, but Spanish, Portuguese, do precisely the same. They all have an English, for the most part, have an English translation of their publications. I didn't see a French translation of an English article in any history of education journal in the English language. Now, one can speculate about why that is the case, and you know, tag onto such speculations whatever notions of linguistic or cultural hierarchy might be at work in Europe or elsewhere be. But my sense is that we likely exist at a time where the technology for translating works, or perhaps even the capacity if we are, you know, recruiting translators, exists in such a way that if there is an interest in or priority over you know, engaging in these conversations across language spaces, then one probably should do that. I think, you know, if I want to think of this as an invitation, you know, I would make this as an invitation to all journals that publish pieces on the history of education, not just in Africa, but anywhere, to consider translating those in other languages and publishing those other translations so that people who are more comfortable in those other languages can have access to them. There might be an increased access where people can read more things, cite more things, and expose themselves to a wider range of conversations. Now, notice again that we're talking about English and French and Spanish and Portuguese, all European languages. We aren't talking about journals that publish in African languages, for instance. And I couldn't find it. I did have some conversations with some people who mentioned that there might be some local journals in East Africa, I think Kenya or Tanzania, but I couldn't lay my hands on any of them, right? These are places I've actually set up some fieldwork, but I haven't found those publications myself in any of my trips. So they aren't as popular, right? So it would be interesting to figure out how you engage in the conversation about history of education in a continent as vast and complex as the African continent by bringing into conversation these very different communities of scholarship. And again, we're talking about Western-style academic scholarship, bringing all of these communities into closer conversation. I think a lot more can be learned about the varieties of issues that are happening. And I think this is also interesting because, you know, one of the lessons I pointed to is that while the majority of publications remain on colonial education, what historians of education are doing with those publications have shifted from, you know, what one can call broad stroke, you know, blueprint historiography, right? You know, this the idea that one is thinking of the colonial versus colonized, you know, categories as monolithic or unified categories. You know, historians have shifted away from that to look at nuances, to look at some of the details and the lived experiences of imperialism. And if you want to engage that process and that history fruitfully, there might be need to ask those questions from the roots, from the perspective of those who've lived those experiences. And my sense is that makes the case for engaging with people who often don't have their sources published in major European journals, right? And that there can be that conversation to happen. I think if I were to turn to the other side of that equation very briefly, one of the things I find striking is that anytime I attempted to go outside of the immediate scope of what's published in English-speaking history of education journals, it's not just that I found a different set of conversations, but even the nature of evidence that people use, the purpose of engaging in historical inquiry, and the audience seem to be quite different, right? What people are doing with history seems to be different than what I find with some of the other journal publications in our context. So I do hope that going forward, there will be increased access and increased conversation and perhaps even increased collaboration where people are truly genuinely interested in the conversations that other people are having that they don't have access to.
Yeah, it's so interesting to hear you say that because in my field in digital humanities, it's a similar conversation happening about like, particularly given the baked in dominance of English into a lot of contemporary technologies, it is often like even more difficult to do sort of technology driven work in other languages, because the assumption is if you're using a computer system that the language that system is going to be written in is English. And there's been a couple of really successful DH projects that work multilingually, and their constant feedback is it's even more challenging than you would think, because just as you said, it's not just a language barrier, but like culturally there's just different reasons for engaging inquiry, different questions, different sources, all of that really shapes the work that people are doing. So it's not just a matter of like, oh yeah, we made this program in French now, so it does everything you need it to do, but sort of much more fundamental questions. So it's so fascinating to see that across fields.
You know, I will tell you a quick story. You know, several years ago, I think this was 2009, I was in India. I was having a conversation with Professor C.J. Daswani, one of India's erudite scholars. He had a lot of work on language and multilingualism. And we were talking about the dominance of English, English language. And he told me a story. I don't remember now if he dated, you know, this event, but he said, you know, there was a time when the British Royal Society was meeting in London, and someone was complaining that scientists do not publish their scientific treatises in English. They were publishing in French. And when this person, you know, raised these concerns, many people at this meeting said, well, you know, that's just the way things are done. The English language is not equipped to handle these scientific, you know, processes. You have to publish in these other languages. And he said to them, if the English language is not equipped to do that, then you develop it, you make it happen. And for someone who grew up in a world where it seems like the English language is the de facto language of communication in the sciences and beyond, it almost seems unbelievable to think that there was a time when the English language was not that. So if we don't have the tools to get that work done, I think human beings can create those tools. If there is any evidence we have from history, it is that we are capable of doing so. We are capable of functioning across what might seem like linguistic divides. And as a matter of fact, it might also seem that doing so is unavoidable. We would not be able to survive as humans if we were not capable of functioning across linguistic, cultural, and even epistemic divides. So that's a task one can embrace, or probably should embrace more intentionally than try to avoid.
Yeah, no, and I think it's such a good reminder that it is not, you know, an inherent dominance, that English is not necessarily, there's nothing predetermined about it, but that there can be those kind of historical shifts. And I think it's really interestingly connected, I think, with the call you make near the end of the article to sort of expand beyond the sort of Western academic understanding of sources as well, and sort of framing that as a challenge to expand the limits of what can be both uncovered and narrated about education in Africa. And I was wondering if you could sort of explain sort of what your hope is behind that call, and what you would be, you know, excited to see historians embracing if they embraced expanding those limits.
Michael, thank you for asking that question. So there are two very specific things I can think of right away, but I imagine there are so many others. So one of the projects I've been interested in came out of an earlier publication. I think it was a 2016 publication in the History of Education Quarterly, where I was engaging, I was trying to explore the origin of British education in a particular part of the southeastern Nigeria. This is within the Igbo context, but I wasn't trying to explore the entire Igbo context, because the entire Igbo context is a very large and diverse context, and missionaries did not get to every part of that Igbo context at the same time. There are some places they arrived earlier and other places they arrived much later. And I was focused on a particular area that was among the most, the latest context they got to. It's actually, in many ways, the meeting point between the spread of Christianity from the south and the spread of Islam from the north. Okay, and in exploring that, you know, it struck me that the majority of publications on the source relied nearly exclusively on European archives. Now, there's a lot to be learned from archives that were developed by, you know, Europeans who were directly involved in the surgeons of, you know, empire building. And like many historians, I'm very glad that we have access to those archives because they tell us plenty today. You know, I was just recently reading Lord Frederick Lugard's, writings, one of his earlier writings, where he was trying to explore the idea of the, I think he called this a trusteeship, the trusteeship idea that guided the effort to explore the rest of the world, especially, you know, what they call the tropics, and to extract raw materials to inform the development of Europe and North America. And in that piece, you know, he was making the argument that the development of industry, which, by the way, was the product of the sustained multiple centuries of engagement with Africa, right, and the rest of the world, the industry would not have, you know, been what it is in Europe without that larger transcontinental engagement. But it has created a lifestyle in Europe and North America that can no longer be sustained using local resources. And there was a need to explore those resources elsewhere. So if you were to follow Lugard's justification for colonialism, for instance, I mean, there's a lot to be learned from those archives. They tell you plenty. But it's also striking to me that we don't seem to focus enough attention on the other stories that are not in those archives. I won't go into this in details right now because I don't think that we have all the time, but I bear in my own identity, my person, my name, my experiences, the imprint, the direct imprint of those missionary explorations. My own father, who is still alive today, lived for many years and worked with many missionary priests, many European missionaries who were in that part of the country for decades. No historian has ever talked to him to understand his perspective on those experiences. Perhaps excepting me, that I just ask him because I know he's a ready source for me. And I can tell you that what I've learned from him directly has been so helpful in reading, in understanding the archives. And so there's no way I would have been able to read those archives in quite the same way if I did not have the likes of my father. And he's not alone. He is one of so many people who are still alive today. So if there is one thing that I'm hoping that historians will do, it is to spend a lot of time in the archives, but then at some point, get out of the archives, get out of the library, get out of the museum. Go to the people themselves. Perhaps there might be a thing or two to learn from them. Many of them are no longer here. But if there is anything I know of parents, it is that they transfer stories to their children. Their children are still here. You know, who are the new generations of the first catechists and the first court clerks? And, I mean, the list goes on of people who worked with the Europeans who were in that part of the world, right? What are the stories they can tell? If we take that step of engaging this as a very important source, I think we would make a lot of progress. I think Felix Ekechi, for instance, or one of Nigeria's most prominent historians, has spent some time exploring this idea and developing a clear argument about why oral histories are very important. In fact, they're essential to any history of Africa, and by extension, any history of education in Africa. As a matter of fact, he makes the argument that the question is no longer whether oral sources are important or helpful, is whether anyone can ever write anything meaningful about the history of Africa without oral sources. And I don't know that it's possible. So that's one of the key things I'm hoping one can take from, or what I would like to see happen, for there to no longer be any publication on the subject that relies nearly exclusively on colonial archives. And I think that's the dominant practice today in 2022. Okay, there was, and I reflect on this briefly in this piece, there was a book, an edited volume by Peter Calloway and Rebecca Swartz that I reviewed not long ago. I think this is Empire and Education in Africa, the Shaping of the Comparative Perspective. You know, this piece, and by the way, I probably shouldn't have mentioned the full title because I don't want to be advertising the book. You use this however you see fit. Mm-hmm. But I mean, and I also say this because I'm critical of some of the things that I find in this book. You know, the key departure point of this book is to engage in the details of, you know, the colonial encounters with education, to understand things from the grassroots perspective. So I was very excited when I first started reading this book. But it was interesting that from the beginning till the end, the focus remained on European actors and what they have to say. I mean, we learn not just their names, but the details of their lives, and nothing about any African in the process. No African is explored as an individual human being whose name we know and whose experiences we can explore. And I think that's tragic. And if my father's own experiences is anything to go by, I do think that there are people who remain alive today who were there when Europeans started arriving, or were part of the story that books like this are talking about. Some of the explorations in this book go all the way to the first half of the 20th century, right? And there are people who are still alive, and it's not just that they're alive, they are very sharp, they have decent memories, and maybe some records too that one can rely on to develop a more a clear and more comprehensive story. Anyway, so that's one key thing I'm hoping will happen. The second key thing, and this is probably a bit more challenging, but also perhaps would be among the most productive, is to recognize that when we say education, we don't mean schooling by default. Now, this is the way that the scholarship sort of carries on the conversation. The history of education in Africa is predominantly the history of Western-style formal schooling. Now, there is a lot happening education-wise, and I'm talking about organized education that has nothing to do with the four walls of a Western-style formal school. You know, I did mention some examples, but the more familiar ones, at least in my southeastern Nigeria context, in the Igbo context, that, you know, is spread now across not only Nigeria but around the world, is, you know, what someone can liken to, I don't want to call it exactly the same thing, but liken to an apprenticeship process that goes in, at least in two different directions. One is, you know, trade apprenticeship. The other one is business apprenticeship, where someone either learns a trade or learns a business and is mentored over a 6 or 7 year period by someone, and take this person through the beginning part of just understanding the basics on a particular field to becoming an expert. And by the end of that process, provides the person with an investment capital to set up their own business or whatever organization they need, and then continue to mentor the person. You know, it is only recently that some people have started paying attention to what is happening in that sector as, you know, a viable venture capital model. But even to call it a venture capital and attempt to subsume it under the rubrics of capitalism is questionable, because that's not what capitalism does. If we function in in the competitive atmosphere of capitalism, if I have a business that I want to thrive, it is in my interest to make sure that it thrives over yours. I don't have an interest in promoting my competitor in such a way that I can be thrown out of business. But that's essentially what's happening in this particular context. Someone who's grooming young professionals are doing so to set up what would be technically their competitors. The only thing is that their sense of well-being is so bonded that they are not thinking exclusively in terms of how to make money for themselves. They're thinking of how to generate resources for the community. This person who has helped to train these other people, if he has any need, say for instance, he takes ill, needs to go to the hospital, he probably doesn't have to think about his medical care because all these people he's helped will be there. He doesn't likely have to think about doing certain things in his community because he's now, you know, helped to produce people who are capable of solving community problems that he himself benefits from. So there's a sense of social responsibility or community responsibility that is at the foundation of what we're talking about. It's very different from what you get in the formal schooling context where you have an individualized effort to learn as an individual and get a grade that is assigned to you as an individual, and you get a job and get paid. So in a sense, you know, your social responsibility, depending on how you think about it, can stretch as far as the tax policy goes. Once you extract the tax from the person, there is really no other obligation, except if the person chooses to engage beyond that. So the point here then is that there is a lot more to be explored beyond the four walls of schooling. And I think there is a lot to benefit from not treating those as the unfortunate fringe space of those who could not make their way into the formal schooling process, which is really the norm. If we think of the formal schooling as just one part of a larger picture, and these other parts are equally viable, equally important, I think historians might be painting a much more comprehensive, even if more complicated, picture of what's happening. I'll say one last quick thing about this. There are many Africans today who, like their ancestors, have to weigh a range of options in making the decision about whether to send their child to school or not. In that previous publication in the History of Education Quarterly, one of the things I found in exploring oral sources was that a lot of parents who sent their children to school at the earliest stages of, you know, missionary schooling in that part of the country did so because they were trying to reclaim political and cultural control over what seemed like a destabilization of their world by the presence of Europeans who were coming in with a range of forces that were new and unique. They were not interested in European education because they thought it had anything superior to provide. And they were very clear about that. They were interested in sending their children to that school because they recognized that some of the people who were getting that education are people who you did not want to entrust the community in their hands. They were people who you did not want to be leaders in the community based on a range of things that were already happening before Europeans showed up. So the effort here was to stabilize the community, right? And I think parents are still doing that nimble dance today. Before they send their children to school, they are looking around and assessing the worth and the value of that schooling. You know, I was just having a conversation earlier this summer with a parent who had sent four of their sons to the apprenticeship Igba Boy or Imwalu process that I was just mentioning. And I was asking them why they made that choice, because the boys seemed like they were doing well academically otherwise in the elementary school. And they were quick to point out to me people in that local community who had gone all the way to the university level. And not only did they not have any useful jobs, they had become nuisance to the community. And they said, we don't want our children to turn out like this. We knew those kids when they were little boys. They were good kids. The only tragedy that happened to them was schooling. The only thing that's different is that they went off to school and a couple of years, now they are a thorn in the, on the flesh of the community. And my sense is, for anyone who just looks at formal schooling as the dominant practice, it might make sense because there are many people who do that, even on the African context. But I think you would also be ignoring a lot of people who look at the same set of data and come to a different conclusion. And there are educational resources that such people explore or exploit that are still viable today. They're still alive, but we don't often think of them as such. We simply just consign them to an informal or non-formal space that receives only secondary attention after we explore the dominant themes.
Well, thank you so much for that incredibly robust overview of the article. I think people really should go take a time to check it out and to read it.
Passing Notes is a production of the History of Education Society UK. Our executive producer is Heather Ellis, and this episode was written by Michael Donnet and produced by me, Seda Ali. You can find a transcript of this episode, as well as more information about our events, publications and conferences at our website, historyofeducation.org.uk.